New music from Tim Barnes behind us right now. It's out on Drag City. It's called Lost Words. The track we're hearing is called Never Touching the Ground. Tim Barnes here, joined by David Grubbs, Tara Jane O'Neill, and Ken Vandermark. Every track on here is a sort of super group. We heard Wanda Jackson and the Party Timers from 1968's Cream of the Crop. Wanda singing Don't Touch Me. James Blackshaw at the top of the set. Gorgeous new record called Unraveling in Your Hands. We heard Why Keep Still. My name is Scott. I look forward to seeing you next week when the new schedule starts. Do stay tuned. Mark Hurst is coming right up with Cory Doctorow on the program. Tectonic is immediately following this program in less than a minute. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Worldwide online at WFMU.org. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. I've got a great interview to share with you today. A repeat guest, author and journalist Cory Doctorow is back on the show. He's going to be talking about a new book he's got coming out, and its title is something that I cannot say over the airwaves, which we're going to mention briefly during the interview, but it's something like infecalization, which has to do with the abuse that big tech platforms and other companies heap upon both customers and business customers. We'll talk all about that in the show. I will note that in one of Cory's previous appearances on Tectonic, he mentioned this term, and it was shortly after he coined it. And so, as I'll point out at the beginning of the conversation, I'd like to think that the early Tectonic interview gave that term just a little push that has now turned into a well-known term that, again, I'm dancing around, and now a book that allows Corey really to flesh out the idea and to talk about how this abuse is, of course, it's very evident in the behavior of the unethical big tech companies in Silicon Valley, but it has spread to other industries as well, as many other companies and sectors are using the exploitative platforms of big tech. If you'd like links to the book and some other resources having to do with Corey's work that we talk about in the interview, go to the playlist. The playlist is at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H tonic.fm, and just scroll down and see the playlist link for the Corey Doctorow episode, and they're all right there. There's also some, I hope, somewhat amusing memes that I have chosen for you on the playlist. But let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Corey Doctorow here on Tectonic. Corey Doctorow, welcome back to Tectonic.
It's a pleasure to be back, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. This is the third time you've been on the show. The first time was in September 2020, talking about your book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. Then in March 2023, you talked about your book, Choke Point Capitalism. And during that interview, you mentioned a new term that you had just recently coined a few months before, a term that I can't say exactly on the airwaves, but I'll call it infecalization. And I think most listeners know what the real term is. That term, the real one, ended up being named the word of the year in the US, Australia, and the UK. And now you have a book coming out with that term as its title. And I like to think that it all started with that Tectonic interview. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. I apologize in advance if I say it. I suppose you can bleep the word if
yes.
I say it. Is that right?
Yes.
Good. Yeah, one of the fun things about having been talking about this word for a few years now, and more importantly, you know, not the word, but the critique that's attached to it, is talking to broadcasters outside of the U.S. who are baffled by the fact that Americans can't broadcast the word infecation without the FCC threatening their broadcast license. So America, land of the free, home of the whopper.
Well, why don't we start with a definition of this term? I want to read something you wrote on your site, pluralistic.net, back in 2023. You wrote, "Here is how platforms die. First, they are good to their users. Then they abuse their users to make things better for their business customers. Finally, they abuse those business customers to claw back all the value for themselves. Then they die." And I'm sure listeners can think of examples where they have experienced that kind of abuse. What's the state of platforms in big tech right now, and where are they in that progression of decay and abuse?
Well, I'd say they're in the zombie stage, right? So most of these platforms should be dead in the sense that we are there not because we like them, but because we love the things that are locking us to them more than we hate them. The most terrible aspect of that would be social media, where the thing that keeps us locked to it is our love for one another. You know, you love your friends dearly, but they're a giant pain in the ass and you can't convince them to do anything. And six people in your group chat can't agree on what movie to see on Friday. There's no way you're going to get the 200 people that matter to you on Facebook to all switch to Blue Sky or Mastodon on the same day. And so long as you all love each other more than you hate Mark Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg gets to make things monotonically worse for you. And so we have these zombie platforms, not just social media, but search. Google is terrible and getting worse by the day and still has a 90% search market share. And Amazon and so on and so on. These platforms are resisting death mostly because they have access to some pretty dark forms of sorcery, like their CEOs can give $1 million each to sit behind Donald Trump on the dais at the inauguration, and then maybe get a favorable outcome in their antitrust trials.
And how much of this has to do with antitrust? Lina Khan was doing such great work until she was shown the door. It seems to me like the monopolies in big tech, as well as in other industries, are a prime mover of a lot of this effect, the abuse and exploitation. How do you see the importance of monopolization in this?
Well, just to clarify a little, Khan showed herself the door. It was pretty clear what was going to happen if she tried to stay. But Trump did illegally fire Rebecca Slaughter and Alvaro Bedoya, two of Khan's colleagues on the Federal Trade Commission, one of whom was hired back, Rebecca Slaughter. Bedoya is now at the American Economic Liberties Project. I think antitrust is foundational here. And I think that it's not because I fetishize the idea of having lots of choices or of competition as a good unto itself. You know, there are a lot of different data brokers that compete for the most efficient way to violate your human rights and take your private data and sell it to scumbags. That's not good in and of itself. We don't want that kind of competition. But what competition does get us is, on the one hand, a form of discipline, where companies do genuinely worry about losing key employees, suppliers, and customers and users to competitors. And all other things being equal, we do like to switch to things that are better. But it also performs a key role in regulation, which is another source of discipline, the one that comes from governments. Because when you have a sector that's disorganized, when there's hundreds of companies in a sector that are all small or medium-sized and they're genuinely competing, they hate each other and they have real collective action problems. That same problem that makes it so hard for you to convince all your friends to leave Facebook on the same day makes it hard for 100 companies in a sector to agree on what they're going to tell their regulator. And as a result, that kind of ferocious competition makes them the kind of rabble that regulators can divide and rule. But when a sector dwindles to just a handful of firms, and in most sectors in our economy, we now see global dominance by five or fewer firms, they find it very easy to come to a common bargaining position with their regulator. And since they don't really compete, right, they tend to divide up sectors or territory. You know, the cable operators don't compete head to head. Apple took $20 billion a year from Google not to make a search engine and so on. Since they don't compete, they have a lot of profits, right? One of the things that both people who are critics of markets and people who love monopolies will tell you is that competition is wasteful. And since they don't have to waste money offering lower prices or higher wages or spending more money on making things better, because they don't have to worry about competitors, they can use some of the savings not for stock buybacks or dividends or executive salaries, but to lobby and corrupt the regulatory process. And, you know, we can talk about that in the abstract, but I'll give you one really quick, very concrete example of how bad the regulatory environment is as a result of monopoly. The last time the U.S. Congress passed a Consumer Privacy Act was in 1988, when they passed the Video Privacy Protection Act that bans video store clerks from telling newspapers which VHS cassettes you have. That is the last technological threat to your privacy that Congress saw fit to defend you from. And this is why we have this totally unregulated data broker sector that's implicated in every kind of terrible thing, from identity theft to nurses who are offered lower wages per shift based on surveillance data about how much credit card debt they're carrying. And nurses that are more in debt are offered lower per shift wages on the apps that hire contract nurses. This is all downstream of regulatory capture, which is downstream of monopoly.
Well, I know a lot of listeners sleep better knowing that their VHS rentals are not being tracked. but there is a general problem of mass surveillance in our society, in our economy. In fact, in a recent column you wrote called Become Unoptimizable, you covered this very topic. You wrote about the growing threat of mass surveillance. You wrote, quote, commercial surveillance allows buyers to figure out the most an individual consumer will pay and raise prices accordingly, and to the point of the nurses you just brought up, to calculate the lowest wage a worker will accept and lower pay accordingly. And in response, you say, to be free people, we don't merely need to be ungovernable, we need to become unoptimizable. So What are you saying there? There's clearly an issue with surveillance, surveillance pricing, surveillance wages. What does it mean to be unoptimizable as a reaction to that?
Well, when I say unoptimizable, I'm referring to this idea that what is optimal for a firm in respect of its customers and workers is not optimal for those customers and workers. Right? The sort of platonic ideal of a firm is a company that can charge infinity dollars and pay zero wages. And if you could figure out how to get people to give you everything they have, and if you could figure out how to get people to work for you without taking any money, you could make a lot more profits. And firms are sort of treating those two outcomes as their North and South Pole stars and always trying to pull in one or the other of those directions. There are lots of ways that we can be unoptimizable, or rather that we can optimize firms for our purposes, you know, that we could force them, for example, to disclose whether they are extracting huge discounts from key suppliers that aren't available to smaller companies the way Walmart does, which lets Walmart sell common household goods for less than its mom and pop competitors pay wholesale. We could impose other optimization requirements. So, for example, to find out whether or not billionaires are corrupting our political process, we could make them publish their tax returns. We could force disclosure of political donations and limit them. Those are all ways to optimize other people to our benefit. And to stop them optimizing us to their benefit, I think one of the first things we can do, in addition to all the stuff that's obvious, like labor law and so on, election law, one of the first things we can do is have effective privacy law. Because you cannot seek to optimize something you cannot measure. Optimization is always a matter of measurement. And so things that are obscured to people who want to optimize you, if they can't know that you're trying to get to a funeral and so they should charge you extra for your plane ticket, if they can't know that you are desperate to get your kid the toy that they've asked for Christmas, if they can't know that you recently searched for information about end-of-life care when you go shopping for medical insurance, then you are in a position to avoid the optimizing gambits of these companies. And they are left relying on these very crude approximations like the airlines have done for years where they say, oh, well, if you're not staying on a Saturday, you're probably a business traveler. And so we're going to charge you extra because we figure you can go to your boss and say, boss, you know, either you pay the extra $300 to send me home on Friday night, or you're going to have to put me up in a, you know, $600 hotel room and pay me $1,000 in overtime to stay over the weekend because I want to see my kids. And so the airlines figure that's the dynamic and they charge extra for the plane ticket. I'm not thrilled about that, but I'd much rather live in a world with that kind of what economists call second order price discrimination than this business where they get you coming and going.
Now, you've mentioned tech platforms, you've mentioned healthcare in the form of those nurses and their wages. You just talked about the airlines. If we just take a step back, I want to read the subtitle of this book because I didn't mention it yet. The subtitle is Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. Why everything suddenly got worse? How do you define everything? How big is this problem, Corey?
Well, look, not every company is a tech company, although more and more companies are availing themselves of technology to do bad things. So, you know, the companies that book nurses for contract shifts are not tech companies. They're just companies with tech. Same with grocery stores that are putting electronic shelf tags and repricing goods based on who's shopping and all these other things that we see as tech kind of slithers out into the real world. But as I said before, most sectors are now heavily concentrated. And so they are maybe not able to pull the specific gambits that tech does, that kind of high-speed shell game where you're changing prices or costs or search rankings or recommendations based on every user who you interact with and every time you interact with them. But it is the case that these companies are still kind of freed from the discipline of markets and the discipline of regulators because of their high degree of concentration. So to give you an example, if you wear eyeglasses, I can probably tell you who manufactured them because one company, Luxottica Essilor, owns every eyewear brand you've ever heard of. They also own Sunglass Hut, Lens Crafters. They own most other high street eyewear companies. They make more than half of the world's lenses.
I should interject that Luxottica also owns Ray-Ban,
That's right.
Which just did a deal with Facebook to create Mark Zuckerberg's surveillance glasses.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, that's bad enough on the one hand. But really, if you're just someone like me who has myopia, your glasses have gone up 1,000% in the last decade because Oliver Peoples, Oakley, Coach, Dolce & Gabbana, Bausch & Lomb, they're all just one company now. And when companies refuse to sell, so, you know, Oakley refused to sell to Luxottica Essilor, they just took them out of all their retailers. And so without Oakley being in Sunglass Hut and Lens Crafters and so on, within a year, it was on the verge of bankruptcy. And Luxottica Essilor bought them for pennies on the dollar. And so that's the position everywhere you look. There's one company that makes all the saline bags. There's one company that owns all the professional wrestling, right? There used to be like 30 leagues. Now there's one, the rapist Trumpy billionaire who owns it, converted all of his employees to contractors and took away their medical insurance. And all the wrestlers you loved in the 80s are begging for pennies to die with dignity in their 50s and 60s on GoFundMe because they've got work-related injuries that they can't get treated, right? It doesn't really matter where you look. You see this kind of monopolism and the concomitant cruelty and impunity that goes with monopoly and that animated the first anti-monopoly movement in the 1890s. And that we lost track of in the 1970s when Ronald Reagan and his court sorcerers put about the idea that monopolies are actually efficient and that the law should not punish monopolies because if everybody uses Google, that tells you that Google has the best search engine and it would be perverse for the government to use your tax dollars to try to shut down the best search engine.
Yeah, and if I understand right, the argument from that side is Google can't be a monopoly because it's free and monopolies... The litmus test for monopolization has to do with price.
Well, it's not that it can't be a monopoly because it's free. It's that it's not a bad monopoly because it's not raising prices, right? And so long as this is the consumer welfare theory of monopoly. It was promulgated by a guy called Robert Bork. And here's a little callback for you. Robert Bork is the guy whose video history got leaked when he was up for a Supreme Court seat, which is why Ronald Reagan signed the Video Privacy Protection Act that bans disclosure of your VHS records. Although, as it turns out, the single best thing you could say about Robert Bork is he had pretty good taste in movies. In every other respect, he was like a virulent racist troll who, you know, I hope that he's comfortable in that lake of boiling that he's in the seventh circle of hell now and that he'll stay in for the rest of time. But you know, he did have pretty good taste in movies. So Bork promulgated this idea, the consumer welfare theory, that the thing that government should step in to do is prevent costs going up. And when you look at the antitrust cases Google has lost recently, and they've lost 3 antitrust cases in the last 18 months, what you often see are prosecutors and plaintiffs looking for ways to think about price that aren't monetary prices. So in one of the cases, you heard a lot about the ad load at Google. So how many ads you have to look at before you see a search result, because the idea here is they're charging you an attention and they're jacking up the price of attention. And there's some truth to that, but it also feels like quite a lot of sophistry to have to go to point out that having one company control 90% of the search queries is just bad for democracy, right? That it makes them not just too big to jail, but too big to care, and that no one should have that power.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. And my guest today is author and journalist Cory Doctorow, who's talking about his new book, whose subtitle is Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. And if you heard the first half of the interview, you heard Cory talk about the various instances beyond social media and big tech platforms where this kind of platform decay or infecalization is starting to appear. If you'd like links to Cory's work and this book and some other resources, go to the playlist, which is at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Find the Cory Doctorow episode and click the playlist link. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Cory Doctorow here on Tectonic. Speaking of those giant, monstrous, unethical big tech monopolies, I wanted to ask, what do you think is the end game here? Because in your post from 2023 that I read from before, the last stage of platform decay is, as you write, then they die.
Yeah.
And that was back in 2023. And since then, I'm very sorry to point out that those monsters in Silicon Valley have only amassed more money and power. Do you still see a death spiral in the future of these exploitative platforms?
So I think they are zombies, right? I think they are the walking dead at this point, because nobody likes them, right? We're just sort of required to use them. As I said before, you know, if you love your friends more than you hate Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg, you'll stay stuck to their platforms. And so on the one hand, that makes them very vulnerable to any kind of intervention that makes it easier to leave, right? If they've got this kind of equilibrium where it's like, well, we've measured exactly how much you'd have to hate us before you gave up on all your friends and left the platform, and we're going to screw you in ways that makes you hate us just a little less than that, then all it takes is, you know, very small shifts in policy, which we nearly got under the Biden administration, where there were some rules being promulgated that would have made it easier to leave the platforms, and that the EU is really digging into the Digital Markets Act that will force the platforms to open up gateways that let you leave but still stay in touch with the people you left behind, the same way you can change phone providers and still receive calls from the people who you were receiving calls from when you're in your old SIM. The other thing is that if it just gets a little worse, we're ready to leave too. But yeah, I worry very much. I also think, though, that one of the ways that these platforms have been able to retain their power, both in the market and in politics, is because companies that are perceived to have a lot of growth potential effectively get to print money. So, you know, companies that want to buy the labor of a key employee or a rival company or a key supplier, they can either pay for that company with stock or they can pay for it with cash. And companies that are perceived to be growth stocks, they have a very high what's called price to earnings ratio. So, you know, for GM, it might be that for every dollar they earn in the course of a year, their stock price is worth about $5, say. But for Tesla, it's like $150. And so what that means is that Tesla can make a lot of shares pretty easily by typing zeros into a spreadsheet. And those shares are pretty liquid. People will accept them as a form of payment. And the problem is that when a company runs out of growth, you would expect its share price to fall to the kind of share price that you see in a mature stock. So when the market stops believing that Tesla is growing, when they think they're just sort of going to be like GM, you'd expect their share price to go from 150 to 1 to 5 to 1. That is going to be a big deal for Tesla, right? It's going to be really hard on Tesla's investors, which means that every time there's bad news about Tesla, you see these mass panicked sell-offs because no one wants to be holding the bag once the sell-off starts. And so people are all sitting there with their hand over the sell button, right, waiting for these growth stocks to turn into mature stocks. So then you got, you know, Google, Facebook, which control 80% of the display ad market online. You've got Google, which is 90% of search. You've got Apple, which has, you know, these commanding markets and everything that isn't Android and so on. And you have to ask, where's their growth going to come from? Like, what is Google going to do to grow its search business, right? Like, they could raise 1 billion new humans to maturity. They call that product Google Classroom, right? But they have to wait 18 years for those people to be like viable consumers that the market will value. And in the meantime, they can pull gimmicks like making search worse so that you have to search more than once to get the same results. So they get to show more ads, you know, to the same person looking up the same bit of information. But mostly what these companies are doing is they're chasing bubbles for the purpose of convincing the market that there is another growth area that they can move into that's as big as the area they conquered. We had metaverse, we had cryptocurrency, we have AI, and all of these bubbles should be best understood as gimmicks by desperate companies that do not want to be revalued as mature stocks. On the one hand, these bubbles are very harmful. They're really bad for everyday savers. You know, the money that blows up the bubble, it's not venture capitalist money. They put the seed money in. The real money comes from normie savers who are just hoping to like not eat dog food in their retirement or force their kids to give up their productive working years to take care of them because they can't afford a nursing home. And those people sink their life savings into these scams and they lose everything. But on the other hand, the fact that these companies are so sweatily desperate to spin a narrative of growth tells you that they themselves do not think much of their long-term prospects.
And in the meantime, they need to maintain a chokehold on their users and their business partners, as you write about. In fact, there's an interesting example of that chokehold in the availability of your new book. Tell us why Amazon refuses to sell the audiobook.
Yeah. So Amazon owns a company called Audible. They didn't start Audible like most tech giants. Their successful companies are other people's companies that they bought, which they can buy for stock because they're a growth company. And so they don't have to use dollars. They can just type zeros into a spreadsheet and acquire other companies. And Audible is now a monopolist. They have more than 90% market share in popular literature audiobooks. And Audible has a requirement that everything sold on its platform, which again, 90% of the audiobooks, they have to be sold with a kind of proprietary encryption called Digital Rights Management, or DRM. Digital Rights Management locks the books to Audible's apps and platform so that if you change businesses, right, if you change audiobook sellers, you can't take your audiobooks with you. So if you spent thousands of dollars on your audiobook collection, that's thousands of dollars you have to forfeit to leave Audible. Just like if you've made a bunch of friends on Facebook, that's a lot of social connections you have to forfeit if you leave Facebook. Now, the law protects this business model. In 1998, Bill Clinton signed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Section 1201 of that law makes it a felony with a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine to provide someone with the tools to go around DRM. So that means that if I, the author of an audiobook, who makes the book, records the book, pays an engineer to master the book, pays a director to oversee the production, sell you a book using Amazon's platform, and then I want to help you take that book with you to a rival platform like, say, Libro.fm or Kobo or something else, the act of providing you with that tool to take the book I made to a platform I think is good carries a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine. And so I don't allow my work to be sold with this digital rights management. It's been an ironclad requirement of mine since, I started my writing career 25 years ago. And Amazon won't carry any book that doesn't have digital rights management. And so the largest platform for audiobooks in the world won't carry my audiobooks. And this means my publishers don't want my audiobook rights, because if you can't sell the audiobooks where 90% of the audiobooks are sold, where are you going to sell them? So I figured out how to sell them. I go into studio, or I pay voice actors like Will Wheaton to go into studio. I record my books, or they record the books. I pay to have them produced. And then I put them on all the stores that aren't Amazon, the ones that make up 10% of the market, except for Apple Books. Apple Books also has DRM as a requirement. So everything except Amazon and Apple, the A's are basically off limits for me. And then I have these Kickstarters where I gin up a lot of interest in not just the book, but this fact that most of us don't know about how platforms lock us in, about how this stupid law from the Clinton era is sitting underneath the reason that we can't fix tractors or ventilators or cars. You can't take your media with you. You can't install third-party apps on your phone. You can't put generic ink in your printer. That's all Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201. It's all the same law doing this mischief. And that turns out to be really successful. I've done this now, I think, 8 times. I'm doing the 8th one now. If you go to your favorite search engine, which I hope isn't Google, but statistically probably is, and type in Kickstarter into the search bar, you will find my Kickstarter. And like the other ones, it's, you know, heading up to 6 figures. And the fact that I've been able to do this has convinced a ton of authors to reconsider whether they're going to go with Audible. The biggest one, of course, is Brandon Sanderson, who's a blockbuster fantasy writer who made millions of dollars doing this and actually got Spotify to change how it was handling audiobooks so that they would be a better rival to Amazon. Because remember, you know, we don't like companies because they're good or bad. we like companies because they impose discipline on one another. And if Amazon is scared of Spotify, they will behave better. And if Spotify is scared of Amazon, they will behave better. We don't rely on their virtue. We rely on their fear.
You're talking about leading a charge on your own for better audiobooks, but I know that in your book, you're talking about much broader solutions.
Yeah.
In the subtitle, it mentions what to do about it. And here you're advocating not so much for individual action, but for collective solutions.
Yeah, look, I'm not saying that you should never think about what you're buying or try to help out people who are trying to do the right thing, but I don't think that makes systemic differences. And I think it's really easy to become a fetishist of commodity consumption choices and to really like make your politics about what you buy, what you eat, and where you shop, which, you know, fine, be conscious of that stuff. But if you do it to the exclusion of systemic work, right? Zephyr Teachout in her great book about monopolies, Break 'em Up, she says, if you don't make it to the protest at the Amazon warehouse because you spent 2 hours driving around looking for someone that wasn't Amazon to buy markers so you could make a sign, Jeff Bezos wins, right? The early reviews for this book, most of them mentioned somewhere along the lines, readers will enjoy this book, become infuriated, be interested and intrigued by the novel policy solutions, but will find it short on individual things that you can do. And of course, you're going to find very little that you can do individually. That's like people reading about the climate emergency are going to find very few ways that they can diligently recycle that will stop them from roasting alive when the next wildfire sweeps through their town, right? The problem isn't how diligently you recycle. The problem is a systemic problem, and we need a systemic solution. Now, the interesting thing about antitrust, the most exciting thing about antitrust, is that over the last 5 or 6 years, we have seen the surge in antitrust action, not just in America, not just under Joe Biden. The first Trump administration did a ton of antitrust. They're the ones who started the lawsuit against Google. But also, we've seen muscular antitrust in Europe of the sort we've never seen there. I know that they have a reputation for being tech regulators, but it's not been this kind of antitrust regulation. Canada, which is where I'm from, as I always say, like all the best Americans, I'm a Canadian. Canada has an incredibly weak history of competition enforcement. Our Competition Bureau, which is analogous to the FTC, it has only challenged 3 mergers in its history, but it's only successfully challenged 0 mergers. But in 2024, the Canadian Parliament gave incredibly sweeping enforcement and investigatory powers to the Competition Bureau, making it one of the most powerful competition regulators in the world. In the UK, we have the Competition and Markets Authority and its digital markets unit. We've seen antitrust enforcement in Japan and South Korea, in individual EU member states like Germany and France and Spain, but also in China, where the cyberspace directive takes aim at giant Chinese tech companies. Because for all that, you know, Red Scare people will tell you that Chinese tech is a stalking horse for the Chinese government doesn't think so. Chinese government thinks that Chinese tech is a rival of the Chinese government and is regulating accordingly. And nobody really knows where this is coming from, because in political science, we have this kind of bedrock belief backed up by pretty good empirical research that if there's something that billionaires don't want, it really doesn't matter how popular it is with everyone else. It won't happen. Hence the climate emergency and the healthcare emergency and the student debt emergency. And yet here we have this thing that billionaires really, really, really don't want. Right. A thing that strikes at the root of corporate power, which is the root of their power. And yet, independently, all over the world, governments are kicking off. Where is this political tailwind coming from? I've heard lots of theories. I have a few sort of half-baked theories of my own, but I don't think anyone knows.
Before I leave this topic of collective response, what are some of the things that you recommend in the book that people do? I mean, is it literally to go to the Amazon warehouse protest? What are some of the things that you're suggesting?
So most of the suggestions in the book are about what policies we should have. How do we get those policies is a separate matter. But broadly, you get it by joining a movement. So I've worked for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is kind of a digital human rights group, for nearly a quarter of a century now. It's really like half my life. And EFF, they're a nonprofit, and obviously we'll take your money just like every nonprofit, and I'll thank you for it because that's one of the things that lets me write all these books is I draw a wage from them. And we're a union shop. But EFF also has a national network of community groups, the Electronic Frontier Alliance. These are locally run, fully autonomous groups that are organized and coordinated by professional organizers on the payroll at EFF who help share their victories with one another so they can replicate them and share tactics when they get defeated so that they can come back stronger. Lots of great local ordinances and actions, especially relevant today when you see localities being turned into kind of surveillance traps that are then feeding into federal roundups and kidnappings of people on the basis of immigration status or even perceived immigration status. Much of that stuff is happening thanks to EFA affiliate groups around the country, as are rules that protect the rights of people who get abortions and so on. So if you're looking for a movement to join, I would start there. I'd start with the Electronic Frontier Alliance. I believe it's EFF.org/EFA. And look for a group near you. And if there isn't one, we'll help you start one.
Okay, beyond this new book, what other projects are you working on, Corey? And second part of my question is, how do you manage to write and publish so much, so often?
Well, the answer to both is kind of the same thing, which is that I write when I'm anxious. And so
that's what you said in 2023. It hasn't changed.
It remains true. I have written since the lockdown, I think it's now 11 books. The one that I'm finishing now is literally typing some of my day's words. It's maybe 3 days away from being done, is a book called The Reverse Centaur's Guide to AI. And it's a book about how to criticize AI without being a dope. Because I think a lot of the criticisms about AI are wrong, and not just wrong, but kind of dangerous. So, you know, on the one hand, like, I don't think AI is going to, like, wake up and take over the world. I think the idea that, like, if we shovel more words into the next word guessing program, it will become conscious is like, well, we keep breeding these horses to run faster. I'm pretty sure one of them is going to give birth to a locomotive, right? Like, the thing that makes us intelligent is not that we're word guessing programs with more words in us. Right? And so it's not going to create intelligence by adding more words to the word guesser. But also, I think that people are quite misguided about the prescription for how AI affects creative labor markets, not because it's not bad for them and not because that's not important. But I think creating more copyrights and copyrights and the ability of people to mathematically analyze works and then publish that mathematical analysis in the form of software, this is not going to produce the outcome that creative workers want. For the one thing, you know, when a company like Getty sues OpenAI, it's not because they like paying photographers. Getty would rather drink a warm gallon of your spit every morning than pay a photographer. And not only that, they've got a giant trove of things that photographers have made and will continue to make and sell to them because they have a monopoly and they're the only game in town. And if you give photographers the right to decide who can train an AI with their work, Getty will just amend their contract to say, right, if you sell to Getty, you're going to have to sign over your training rights. And then instead of OpenAI taking those photos for free and then selling Getty a tool for $100 million that lets them fire all their photographers, OpenAI will pay Getty $50 million for the training data and charge OpenAI $50 million for the tool that fires all the photographers. And the photographers can sleep well knowing that before they went on the breadline, a different person ate half their lunch, right? And I think that if you really want to, you know, screw up the plans of the AI companies and the people who want to fire creative workers, you should lean into what the U.S. Copyright Office has said, which is that algorithms don't get copyrights for the things they make. Because the only thing Getty hates more than paying photographers is not having copyrights in their photos.
Right.
And so if you say to them, make all the photos you want with an AI, but anyone can take them and sell them or give them away, they're just going to pay photographers. And so this is a book. It's a short book, about 40,000 words, and it's about understanding the real material dynamics of AI and how to criticize it in a way that improves the odds for working people who are in the crosshairs of AI companies and the bosses who are so insatiably hard to replace them with software and to make a better world.
I appreciate that you're spending some time on a more measured critique of AI because, as you say, there's a lot of bad criticism out there.
Yeah.
Lee, is it Lee Vinsel who came up with Critihype?
Yeah, Lee Vinsel, Critihype. There's a whole chapter on Crita Hype in this book.
Oh, good.
I think all of my books are going to end up having a chapter on Crita Hype because it's such a smart idea when you repeat the boasts of a company, but as criticism. So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg goes out and says, you know, I've got a mind control ray. I can sell anyone anything with my big data mind control ray. And then Mark Zuckerberg's critics go out and say, Mark Zuckerberg has a mind control ray. This is terrible. And then Mark Zuckerberg's salespeople go to advertisers and say, I suppose you're wondering why you should pay a 40% premium to advertise on Facebook. I think you should listen to our critics who will tell you that we have a mind control ray. And wouldn't that be great if we could let you use it?
Yeah, my favorite is when the tech companies say, we have created God. It must be stopped. And there's only one company that can stop it, us, you know.
Yeah. Well, and also that, you know, AI can do your job, which manifestly it cannot, you know. And when we conflate an AI can convince your dumb boss, an AI company can convince your dumb boss to fire you and replace you with an AI that can't do your job, with an AI company is going to make a product that can do your job, we're helping them sell their products. We need to make sure that we are focused on what the AI companies can actually do and not what they're claiming they can do. So beyond that, I've got other writing projects. There's a graphic novel of Inscription coming out next year. There's also a graphic novel of my novella, Unauthorized Bread. It's a kind of dystopian resistance story, science fiction resistance story. It'll be a middle grades book that's coming out also from First Second. I have, I'm talking with my publisher about a young reader's version of Inscription. And there's also a documentary that's underway about Inscription that I'm helping out with. I have other writing projects. I've got to write one more Little Brother short story, and then I'm going to do a little book of them. And I'm also about to publish a tiny little novelty art book, because I make these weird collages with my blog every day. I use nothing but public domain and Creative Commons sources. And I've gotten so captivated with collage, political collage artistry, that I'm doing a tiny book of them called Canny Valley, that the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling has written a wonderful introduction for. I literally just got the proofs back the other day, and it's going to be given away as a premium with Creative Commons donations for their 25th anniversary. And I've saved 100 copies out of the run that I'm selling along with my latest Kickstarter. And then if people like it, I might do them every year, because I love doing these little collages.
And collage, because that falls under fair use, right?
No, I'm not relying on fair use for the most part, every now and again. But mostly what I'm relying on is public domain and Creative Commons licenses. So it turns out that if you want to illustrate subjects related to Monopoly, that there is a wealth of public domain Gilded Age editorial cartoons, particularly by this guy, Kepler, who founded the magazine Puck. I always mix it up with Punch. He founded Puck magazine. And Kepler was this like driven oil painter illustrator who not only ran this weekly magazine, but made like two paintings a week for the magazine, the cover and usually an interior. And they're just wicked editorial cartoons. You probably know at least one or two of them. There's a very famous cartoon of AT&T as a giant fanged octopus, or not AT&T, Standard Oil as a giant fanged octopus with its tentacles around the White House and Congress and so on. That's a Kepler. And there's another one called The Real Masters of the Senate, which is the Senate chamber with these bloated plutocrat billionaires around it in a kind of in the galley, staring down at the infinitesimal ineffective senators, and they all have the logos of big companies on them of the day. That's also a Kepler. He was a banger, and it's all in the public domain. So I spend hours cutting them up with a trackball and the lasso tool, and mixing them in with stuff from Creative Commons, stuff that is a federal authorship, because that's all in the public domain. And then things that are fair use, like when I'm criticizing Mark Zuckerberg, I often use his metaverse avatar, because it's canonically fair use to take something from a company in a way that doesn't undermine the market power for that thing, and then use it to criticize them.
Well, his avatar was just calling out to be used in that way. Those dead cartoon eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Cory Doctorow, you are a busy man, and I want to let you get back to writing your 25 books that are in the pipeline right now, as well as your blog at pluralistic.net. I'm going to put links to everything we've mentioned here on the playlist. Good luck on the promo for this new book, and I hope you'll be back again. in the not too distant future. I really appreciate you spending time with us.
Well, I hope the listeners will check it out. And I'm going to be in, I believe, 28 cities between September and December. So I hope if I'm in your city, you'll come out and say hello.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with author and journalist and activist Cory Doctorow, who's got a new book coming out called, not called Infecalization, but something close to that. And it's got its subtitle that is Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. I hope you got an idea from the interview of the range of experiences in our lives and work that are affected by this idea of platform decay that seems to be spreading everywhere. Since, as Cory pointed out, so many different kinds of companies are using the exploitative platforms of big tech, and so the exploitation that's built into them naturally arises in their uses and in other arenas. In the interview, Cory, as I was listening to the interview here, I thought it'd be fun to write down the different types of examples that he brought up. So Cory mentioned social media, like Facebook and Twitter and the rest. Search, he gives Google as an example. The search quality of Google is declining. He mentions Amazon, although he didn't go into much detail, but Cory has written, and I've certainly talked on the show about the decay of Amazon and its treatment of users and workers and business customers. Data brokers are continuing to be a big problem. We definitely need some regulation there. He mentions the nurses. By the way, the issue of nurses being paid a lower wage based on their amount of credit card debt, I wanted to point out that I mentioned this in a recent Tectonic. If you go back to, I think it was July 28, 2025, you can find this on the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm, and find the Three Emerging Dystopias episode. And I talked about the nurses being exploited in that way, which I learned about from Cory's newsletter at pluralistic.net originally. Cory went on to talk about monopolies being generally a problem, and he named Luxottica, that maker of eyeglasses, as well as the owner of Sunglass Hut and other companies, as a case in point. And wrapping it all up, Cory says something that I've agreed with for a long time and have said on the show a number of times, which is that this is a systemic problem. And while there are individual responses that we can make by, well, just listen to my advice at the end of the show, getting off Google for one, if we want a solution to the systemic problem, we have to work systemically. And there's no one silver bullet fix to all of this. It's going to be a multi-pronged approach. We need a movement. We need cooperation from workers and legislators and consumers and activists and NGOs and all sorts of actors working together to deconstruct this monopolistic threat. And for anyone who's super pro business, by the way, this is bad for business. You know, as Cory points out, competition is better in the long run for businesses. You can go back and read your history on the AT&T breakup, the Ma Bell breakup, in which all of the pro business voices said, "Oh, this is going to be terrible." You know, breaking up the phone company is going to be, and actually it made a lot of money for a lot of entrepreneurs because it freed up a lot of innovation, if that's what you're after. It's also very good for consumers. So what one main thing that we need is more encouragement of antitrust actions. But that's not it. I mean, we're also going to need more legislation on privacy. I'd love to see some significant penalties against the big tech companies for their law-breaking behavior. And there have been some hints at criminal charges recently. I mean, there was, a judge recently was talking about possible criminal charges against Apple executives for their behavior in a recent trial. Speaking of Apple and Google, by the way, I liked what Corey wrote in his newsletter on August 26th. This is all, by the way, on the playlist at tectonic.fm. Corey writes, like Apple, Google has a track record of selling its users out to oppressive governments. Apple blocked all working privacy tools for its Chinese users at the behest of the Chinese government, while Google secretly planned to release a version of its search engine that would enforce Chinese censorship edicts and help the Chinese government spy on its people. And here Corey includes a link to the infamous Dragonfly project. This was going to be a search engine that Google was trying to offer to the Chinese government to help spy on Chinese citizens. And Corey then continues, Google's CEO, Sundar Pichai, personally gave $1 million to Donald Trump for a seat on the dais at this year's inauguration. So did Apple CEO Tim Cook. Both men are in a position to help the self-described dictator make good on his promise to spy on and arrest Americans who disagree with his totalitarian edicts. So here you see, friends, the problem of monopolization and concentration of power and the platform decay that Corey writes about that inevitably follows in the wake of concentration of power is not simply an issue of we're getting bad search results and the business environment is locked down and all sorts of bad things are happening to users and business customers. That's all apparent and true, but it goes beyond that. Now, with the alignment, the close alignment of these big tech beasts with the current occupant of the White House and his authoritarian leanings, we have a political crisis that these platforms are now poised to be used to accelerate. I'm not going to say initiate the surveillance state because we already live in a surveillance state, but to accelerate the surveillance state and to more fully weaponize it for the whims of the current occupant. As Corey writes, if the current occupant makes good on his promise to arrest Americans who disagree with his policies, then you know what platforms are going to be used for this. It's going to be the big tech platforms. And so the problem that we are facing is cultural and social and economic and commercial and political. It is all of these aspects wrapped into one. This infecalization, this platform decay affects all of us, and it is accelerating. So it is urgent that we start working on a systemic solution, or I should say a basket of systemic solutions. We're going to need this to dig ourselves out of this. I suppose the current arrangement materially benefits 8 dudes on the west coast of the U.S. so that they can add more wings to their many mansions. I'm not sure that actually benefits them, though. But it certainly does not benefit the rest of us. And so it's time for the rest of us to start working on these systemic solutions. I really appreciate Cory Doctorow being on the show a third time. Again, if you'd like links to the resources tonight, and if you'd like links to the past 2 episodes with Cory, they're all available for free at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. I also want to thank Kirk Pearson for slightly new versions of our music today that I'm going to be using. They did a great job on the composition, the production of all of our Tectonic music. So thank you, Kirk. And I want to remind you that you are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel. Until next time, friends, I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And another friend and past guest, Michael Hurst, has a new song out with Claudia Gonson from Magnetic Fields called Eyes Without a Face. Anyone of a certain age will know this. I really like this version. I'll see you next time, friends. Have a good one.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Did the first couple seconds of that track get cut off? This is very upsetting. Did we not hear all 38 seconds? I think I accidentally cut off a second or two. You know what? Next week I'll play the extra 2 seconds just to get the balance, get the universe back into balance. Anyway, welcome everybody. This show's called It's Complicated. Subtitle: An Hour of Prog and Prog Adjacent Music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I present this show every week, every Monday evening. I'm here even on Labor Day. This is not labor. This is a labor of love, you might say. I'm going to start tonight's show with music from a group called Gilgamesh, English band that was, I guess, led by a guy named Alan Gowen, G-O-W-E-N, and they're loosely grouped in with the Canterbury bands, as will be obvious when you hear them, the instrumentation. And they actually, Alan Gowen played with a few notable Canterbury or Canterbury adjacent people, like guitarist Alan Holdsworth and Jamie Muir, percussionist, who was percussionist in King Crimson. Anyway, we're going to hear a track from a self-titled album from 1975, Gilgamesh, and here we go. Thank you.